On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Here she is, the woman behind it all, author J.K. Rowling, in an interview earlier this month on how it felt to write the seventh and presumably final book of the Harry Potter series, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows.
Actually, finishing it was the most remarkable feeling I've ever had, and I couldn't have told you which was uppermost, euphoria or feeling devastated.
This hour on Point, we're talking about the end of the epic seven-book series and what made Harry Potter huge. We're joined this hour by three Harry Potter readers who have given the whole thing some special thought. Julie Just is the children's books editor at the New York Times Book Review. She joins us from New York. Julie, thanks for being here.
Hi.
Also in New York, Lee Siegel, art, television, and book critic, author of Not Remotely Controlled, Notes on Television. He's senior editor at the New Republic and a Potter reader. Lee Siegel, welcome back. Good to have you.
Great to be here.
And from Riverside, California, Craig Svonkin is with us, a lecturer in English at UC Riverside. He was chairman of the Potter Mania 2005 conference, stands where Harry Potter meets academia. Among his scholarly papers, Harry, Hogwarts, and Theories of Childhood and Pedagogy, and Muggles and Giants and House Elves, Oh My, Harry Potter, Liberalism and Evil. Oh, Craig Svonkin, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's great. Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you all. Julie, just this thing is just as huge as it can be, and here we are with the last one coming down the pike and people camping out to be first in line, and suddenly we've got references to Dickens and Tolstoy and C.S. Lewis and Tolkien and practically the Iliad and the Odyssey. Let's just dive straight to it. What do you think has made this such an enormous, enormous series of books for people?
Well, to some degree, I think you would need a battery of psychologists or anthropologists to talk about the psychology of fads and a cultural moment that people get involved in. You don't get many of those. I mean, it may be once in a generation you get the Beatles or Star Wars. And we hadn't had one lately. And in fact, I think you have quite the opposite. Maybe the only thing we all do is go to Home Depot on a Saturday afternoon, you know. And I think that there has been a sense that people were missing something. And so as the kids and the teenagers got so excited about this, adults caught on very quickly. And the sales figures began to create a momentum of their own. I mean, that's at least part of the explanation.
$325 million. And I guess we should make sure right here at the outset, I should ask each of you, Julie, first, have you read the latest one, the last one? Michiko Kakutani, the New York Times has, and J.K. Rowling's all upset about it. Have you read it, Julie?
No, I've got my copy on reserve at my local independent bookstore, and I'm buying it tomorrow.
Okay, so nothing given away there. Lee, swear on your heart, cross your heart and hope to die. Have you read it?
I have not read it.
Okay, and
no,
Craig?
I have not.
No, I'm getting it at midnight tonight.
Okay, so there will be nothing, no one has to worry about learning the exciting climax of the series right here, right now. Craig, how do you look at this one? Harry Potter is ginormous, as my kids would say, 325 million copies. Why this amazing, huge thing?
Yeah, it's a strange phenomenon. I mean, of course, when you have one of these strange, huge public responses, it's always an anomaly. When Charles Dickens' best books came out, they were huge responses, and now it's sort of hard for us to understand. I think there's a number of reasons why it's so big, though. First, because children really do relate to it. It has that kind of archetypal children's story plot where a child who has no power, children relate to that powerlessness, is suddenly given power. So I think it has that story, but also adults are really responding to it. Scholastic has estimated that 30% of the readers or of the books are over 35. So
over 35, so over 21 could be half, I don't know.
It could be half of the readers, exactly, which is really unheard of for a children's book for a long, long time. And I think some of that is because Rowling is exploring issues of mortality, complex issues of who the main character is and whether he's being formed from external forces or can choose his own path. And some of it is really just marketing. I mean, we have to admit this, that we're in a new age where you know, hundreds of radio stations. Everybody's covering it. Huge media power from Scholastic, and where the blockbuster mentality really does sort of spur on more and more interest in the same works.
There's the chicken and the egg. Lee Siegel, I don't know who would be covering it, though. On the other hand, if it weren't so big and it got big somehow, we know just how excited people are about it. Was there some vacuum waiting to be filled, some need unmet in modern society, Lee, that this rushed into?
Well, I think it got big by itself. I disagree that marketing is responsible for this terrific appeal of this book. Rowling has created a self-enclosed world. It's the kind of world novelists used to create. Yes, Dickens. Yes, Balzac. Yes, Tolstoy. Of course, C.S. Lewis, etc. She's a wonderful synthesizer. She has managed to incorporate visual elements. You know, these books are written, but she's wonderful at expressing, making things very vivid visually. They're cinematic, and I mean that in the best sense.
Right down to the smallest details of owls and rafters.
That's right. She knows how to hold the attention of people who have grown up looking at screens. And in that sense, you know, there are two things happened in the course of these Harry Potter books: the internet and 9/11. I don't want to reduce everything to 9/11. There's a whole cult of that. But it certainly has made people start to imagine the unimaginable. And the internet, you know, everything is connected. And you click on something in the internet and it becomes something else. You sort of click on her characters and suddenly they become enchanted. And finally, I think that her fantasy is actually very down to earth, as opposed to a lot of so-called adult novels where the preciousness of the language and the psychological obtuseness makes them seem very surreal. But her fantasy is practical and concrete. You really get the sense when you're reading her books of a person who started writing them out of completely disinterested motives. That's also very rare in our society. She didn't want to become famous.
The mom in the cold water flat on welfare, needing something to do with her baby.
That's right. It's a beautiful story. It's what every artist wants to create. It's the way it used to be, in fact. She wrote for her children and for herself to transport herself. And this force of transporting, this transformation, she has conveyed to her readers. You literally read this book and feel that your life is being changed. It's an illusion, but you have that primal feeling of transformation. Mm.
Julie, just it's fascinating to get to the heart of this. I mean, you come from a literary family. Your dad's Ward Just, written many novels. You've worked as a literary critic for a long time, not just in children's books. So is there something about this book that is fitting into a hole that's been left unfilled by all those other legions of literary writers who, and for that matter, children's who've been out there banging away for decades?
I think it partly has to do with the nature of fantasy. One thing you see about kids now, just to talk about the kids' side of it, they are intensely busy. Kids have jobs now. I mean, applying to college now is a full-time job. So when you hear the statistic that Harry Potter has not, in fact, turned kids onto reading, that it won't lead them to become readers, it won't lead them onto other books, I think you have to keep in mind that they don't have any time to read. It takes something to tap into their passions to get them to put down their college applications and their sort of test preparation. So when you have something that, as Lee says, I think sort of taps into their feelings of powerlessness and a desire for a deeper meaning, the sense that there's evil in the world and there's great danger in the world. We know that kids are not, for the most part, growing up to read newspapers. They're not following the news. But they know about Iraq and they know about global warming. And I think through these books, kids and adults, and that's where I would bring in what literary writers maybe not be doing as much of, Rowling is dealing, as she said, the books are about death. I don't know if the books are about death, but they're certainly about evil. And as you see the books darken by book, certainly 5 and 6, I think it's fascinating. I believe it's book 5 that she was writing in 2002, mm-hmm. after September 11th, mm-hmm. when you really have a sense with the Ministry of Magic. We know who the bad guys are. We no longer know who the good guys are.
Everything gets murky.
There's no sense of certainty that the good is going to win out.
But there's this funny, I don't know if it's a contradiction. On the one hand, there's evil and death, and yet you can feel it. And I'm sure bookstores around the country will feel it tonight. There's also, Julie, a kind of group high among people who know they're all reading the same thing and all racing to, you know, get to the details and talk about it.
Well, that's partly because what kids will tell you about what they respond to the books is maybe a little bit different from what adults respond to. They love the friendship in the books. They love the theme of loyalty. They love the theme of sacrifice for something that you believe in. The characters are central for them. Harry is central. Again, the friendships are central. And that gives them, I think, a feeling of hope and overall a positive feeling, no matter what happens in book seven.
We're talking this hour about Harry Potter on the eve of the last book's release, talking about what's made Harry Potter huge. Here's a little bit from the trailer for the new movie, Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, released earlier this month.
Every great wizard in history has started out as nothing more than what we are now. If they can do it, why not us?
Sort of exciting, isn't it? Stupefy! Breaking the rules.
Who are you and what have you done with Hermione Granger?
You're a really good teacher, Harry.
Sort of exciting, isn't it? Lee Siegel joins us from the New Republic, Julie Just from the New York Times, and Craig Swonkin from the University of California, Riverside. Let's go to Ed in New Haven, Connecticut. Ed, you're on the air.
Hello. Yes, I think it's a whole bunch of things, but one of them is that the Harry Potter books are really a fun read. I convinced my younger daughter to buy one from buy the first one from Scholastica when it came out. And because I had heard some very good things about it in press, and we read it, and she loved it, and she went to one of the parties. But I think the basic thing is it's a fun read. I think a lot of for adults too, and because I think part of it is that a lot of adult literature has gotten too much into verbal fireworks and sex or violence, and people have gotten tired of it.
So go off to a fun read. On the other hand, we've got death and destruction here, but we got the picture, Ed. Let's go to Karen in Bellingham, Massachusetts. Karen, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. How are you, Tom?
Pretty good. What do you know?
Well, my whole family, we range in age from 9 to 44.
Okay.
I'm the oldest, and we totally love the Harry Potter series. And I was telling your screener, I'm here doing some child care for my sister for the next 2 weeks. And about 3 or 4 weeks ago, I had this moment of panic when I realized I had agreed to come over the time that the book seven was being released.
Uh-oh.
And I made her go to a local bookstore and sign us up for a book and make sure that we could attend a party. And I literally have been sitting at the kitchen table for the last 4 days. As I speak to you, I'm finishing the last hem on my daughter's cape. She's dressing as Tonks, and my son is Harry Potter. And for us, we're going to stand in line, and this is what we did last with book six. We're going to come home tonight, and we're going to sit on the couch at midnight, and we're going to read the chapter out loud. And every night we read a chapter out loud as a family until the book ends. And I think, you know, for us, and the kids wouldn't know this, but I think the most important thing about this book is how well it's written. I mean, I feel like it's, you know, I read out loud to my kids a lot, and sometimes my mind wanders while I'm reading words. But this is a book that is very well written. She doesn't leave any holes. And I think the relationships between the characters are so real that, like, this sounds ridiculous coming from a 44-year-old, but I feel like they're my friends. And I have friends. I'm not a
fancy friend. It's not only Potter characters. Are you worried about, everybody says there's going to be some serious trouble, mortality will be on display in this book. Are you worried about that with your 9-year-old?
No, not at all. In fact, I think, in my view, I mean, this is just a theory, of course. I don't know what's going to happen in this book, but I sort of feel like from book one, J.K. Rowling has been setting this up, and it's the only way for the book to end is for Harry to die. I mean, I really think he has to join his family wherever they are.
So you're bracing yourself for it. Karen, thanks for that call. Karen, thanks very much, and make those cape seams straight. Lee Siegel, give us a little more deconstruction here. A fun read, we hear, and yet it's going to be, everybody seems to expect, Karen said this, about death. It's not that it shies away from woe and trouble and mortality. So how's that unfolding? How's that working in the magnetism here?
Well, the great children's stories have always taken up those subjects. There's nothing new in that sense. Think of Roald Dahl, you know, he's very dark. And you have this kind of darkness in The Hobbit and in C.S. Lewis. And I'm putting my reputation on the line here, but I can't imagine that she'll knock Harry off.
Okay, it's just, we'll know soon enough. Okay.
The darkness, yeah. Children, you know, they love to be scared. They hate to be scared. They're thrilled to be scared. They want to be consoled. She touches all those elemental feelings. But, you know, listening to the little bit you played from the trailer, the music, I was reminded again, the music sounds like Prokofiev. You know, those great Russian romantic lilting rhythms. And this book, it occurred to me that this book has brought romanticism back into literature. I mean, romanticism once concentrated on the individual, but pulled the individual out of himself through larger-than-life feelings. And in our age, romanticism's been contracted to just a sort of solipsistic, self-enclosed little me. And she's brought these larger-than-life feelings back into it. You know, the individual's at the heart of her story, Harry Potter, but he's constantly brought out of himself through his interactions with other people and with moral forces, good, evil, and the ambiguity of good and evil. And it's a very romantic book, and I think that for decades, people making culture, high cultures, low culture, have been looking to reintroduce the romantic, because that's what people respond to most passionately.
Julie, maybe that's what's been missing. Maybe exactly that romantic theme that J.K. Rowling unfolds again and again here.
I am reminded a little bit of the feeling in the 1970s when people started to buy Japanese cars. And you had the feeling, they're trying to tell us something. They don't like what we're making. You know, the U.S. car makers then took a very long time to get the message. I think that there has been a feeling that there's something in literary work that writers for adults are almost embarrassed to write about good and evil. They're embarrassed to write about the quest, embarrassed to take on the big subjects that Lee's talking about. And you almost have to look to genre fiction like fantasy and science fiction to find it. I do think that one reason that people responded so much to the corrections a few years ago, Jonathan Franzen's book, before Oprah and after Oprah, was that there's a tremendous feeling of unease in that book. And in fact, there's a touch of fantasy, although not a great deal, sort of set in the near future. The feeling that the anxiety that besets this family as the father is sort of breaking down is mirrored events in the country. And I remember the first page of the book sets that up very well. And it was a book that somehow had national resonance, I think.
Craig Svonkin, we're talking about the future there and maybe some fears around it, but you also see among adult fans of this series a kind of nostalgia at work.
I do. I think one of the reasons why children's literature is becoming so popular in general, not just with Rowling, but with Philip Pullman and others, is based on nostalgia, that nostalgia for that first ludic reading experience, that first experience of reading a children's book and getting totally encompassed in that character. I remember when I read The Hobbit or Lord of the Rings, just, you know, crying when those characters died and really feeling that it was true. And in when you start reading postmodern literature or a lot of contemporary literature, which is metafictional and reminding you that it is literature, I think that takes you away from that experience. And so I think some of this is nostalgia for those earliest transformative reading experiences.
You've looked back at reading history and other moments and times and books that have brought great crowds to their feet, as Harry Potter has here. What precedents do you see, Craig?
Well, there's quite an interesting precedent with Sherlock Holmes, and a lot of writers try to kill off their favorite characters, and then the crowds want to bring them back, as happened with Sherlock Holmes, or L. Frank Baum tried to end his Oz series after a number, got tired of it, and tried to write other fantasy, and the children writers demanded a return to it, which is interesting. I mean, part of the appeal of this is that it is serialized fiction. I think people love getting attached to a character and attached to a world, and the world becoming completely complex and interesting. And the idea that that world is going to be closed off to them is really, I think, painful. So some of this happened in these earlier serialized works, you know, like Dickens's works, which would come out chapter by chapter.
You remind us of Dickens, 1841, The Old Curiosity Shop, an American standing on the pier waiting for the ships to bring over the final cereal so they could know how it all ended.
Right, and calling to the, you know, to the ship, is Little Nell dead? And so that anxiety about the characters that we're having with Harry is certainly not completely new. I mean, this is something that some of the most powerful works of fiction, especially serialized fiction, where you don't know it in one book, you know, you don't get it in one installment, and you have, and the readers have time to become attached to the characters and anxious about their fate. That's sort of an anomaly with serialized fiction.
Potter fans, you are not the first. Let's go to Dalton, Georgia, and Wes. Hi, Wes, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I think that the essence of all this is the story. I mean, I think that's what your panelists are talking about. It's just a great story, and that's something that's really missing these days. It's missing in the general media. It's missing in movies and television. It's just, you have a story, and that's something you can follow along. I have three daughters, and we read all the books when they come out. And
but aren't there a million stories out there, Wes? I mean, what is it that wraps the cloak around all of you on this one?
I you can't really put your finger on it. I mean, it's for my girls, for example, Hermione, the character of Hermione Granger, the fact that she is so smart, and she's the smartest one, you know, and I can look at my girls and say, see, she's the smartest one. She's doing so well in school, and that really, you know, it inspires them almost, I think. My daughter has become an avid reader because of these books.
And she's hardly alone in that, and we're glad for it. Wes, thanks for your call. Let's talk to one of those young readers, a fairly prominent one. Laura Greenlee joins us from Boston. She is the Amazon.com Harry Potter Kids correspondent. 17 years old, began reading Harry Potter books in the third grade with her father. She's now going into her senior year of high school. Laura Greenlee, thanks for being with us.
Hi, thank you, Tom. How are you?
We're great. So your whole sort of reading life is framed by Harry Potter. Are you going to be one of those frantic people at the front of the line tonight, or is Amazon shipping you one special?
I'm actually going to order it online, but I am going to Harvard Square, which is going to be turned into Hogwarts Square for tonight, and that's going to be really fun. There's going to be a lot of different events there, and I'm really excited for that.
So what's it meant to you? I mean, this will be seven books in the course of, I don't know, a little more, like something like 10 years for you. It's really, really defined your youth in many ways. What are you taking from it?
I really like the books because they have this, you know, really magical element, and I can still kind of be a kid, even though I'm trying to grow up. I can still be a kid when I'm reading those books, and yet at the same time, Harry.
Sounds like we lost Laura for a moment there. Julie, you can hear from third grade to senior in high school, you know, one book after another, and she's got a kind of a glide path here along with her. He's growing up at the same time.
Well, it's amazing when you talk to a 17 or 18-year-old and they started reading the books when they were roughly Harry's age. It's a particularly great experience for them, and I talked to a 17-year-old the other day who's turning 18 in August, and she feels a particular melancholy about it. But I'd like to speak to the point about what it means for girls. I think it's been done very subtly but very powerfully by Rowling. Not just Hermione, but a reader was pointing out to me, I was aware of this and yet not aware of it, that on the Gryffindor Quidditch team, they have girls on that team. Slytherin doesn't. You know, and you kind of absorb these things without Rowling hitting you over the head about it. But I think it's tremendously inspiring to kids, and particularly to girls.
Yeah, let's go to Asher in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Asher, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So, I think it's really interesting that the way that these books have become extremely popular, when they combine elements from a lot of other books, books that didn't necessarily become so popular, like you see Fluffy, which is like Cerberus from Greek mythology.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what it is, but she writes really well, which combines the elements. but I have read books with better writing. But there's something about it, and I can't put my finger on it, and I don't know that anybody can.
Asher, you're 12 years old. Have you read all six that have come out so far?
So far, yes.
That must have taken up a fair portion of your young reading life.
I read the sixth one in about 3 days.
Okay, so high speed, pedal to the metal.
My family did not see me at all for those 3 days while I was reading it.
And what do you want? What do you expect from the last one? What are you hoping for?
Well, I know that Harry's not going to die. If you look at every fantasy book for kids, or for most of them for adults, too, the main protagonist never dies. Maybe, you know, the secondary protagonist, you can never be so sure.
You say that with enormous confidence. Are you really that sure?
Yeah, actually, I am, pretty much. Because, also, look what would happen. If Rowling killed off Harry, there would be, you know, just be a huge outcry. And also, I think she's been hinting that there might or might not be more books. And that can't happen if Harry is dead. And, you know, if you see, like, Harry going through all this thing, and then the main protagonist dies, and it all ends miserably, what sort of message does that send? No matter how hard you work, you might die, and it's all bad and too bad, you know?
Wow, Asher, you're the best. Send your review to Julie Just at the New York Times. Thanks for calling. I think we've got Laura Greenlee back. Laura, what about you? What are you expecting from the last one? What are you hoping, fearing, dreading, hoping?
One of the main things that I'm hoping for as a teenager is that Hermione and Ron get together because they're meant to be. Another thing that I actually think that Harry will die trying to protect the rest of humanity. I think that he will die fighting off Voldemort, and that they will both have to die together. And I think that it will be like he's dying for everybody else.
You've grown up with Harry almost right at the same speed. Has Rowling's depiction of his maturation helped you? Have his struggles helped you think about your own, to find yourself, find your powers?
It has definitely helped me. I mean, there's one instance that I can really remember clearly is that when I was turning 13, the fifth book came out, and Harry was going through a lot of similar struggles as me. The teenage angst, trying to find out, is he a kid, is he an adult?
Laura Greenlee, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
In the new movie, Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, Hermione asks Harry to teach her and their friends how to defend themselves. Harry explains to them what it is like to fight evil.
Facing this stuff in real life is not like school. In school, if you make a mistake, you can just try again tomorrow. But out there, when you're a second away from being murdered or watching a friend die right before your eyes, you don't know what that's like.
And there it is. Lee Siegel is here from the New Republic. Julie Just, children's book editor of the New York Times, and Craig Svonkin joins us from Riverside, California, a lecturer in English at the University of California, Riverside. Lee, you talk about how Harry Potter revolves around inevitabilities and tough ones, death, loneliness, depression. I mean, it's not like it's all just Quidditch and hurrah.
Yes, that's right. I think, and in some strange way, I think that's consoling. You know, what's remarkable about her books is that the first principles of this world, this self-enclosed world that she's created, are transparent all the time. Appearances might change. There are mysteries that are not solved that go on. Things shift, but the poles are there. Harry and his parents and Voldemort and the moral issues, and there's something incredibly reassuring about that. That through all the storm of emotions and terrors and the bad things that happen, there is this world where the poles don't change. You know, I mean, everybody knows what's wrong, most of us, but it's very hard to know what's right, you know? And in this book, things, through all the confusion, they make sense. Even the worst terrors are consoling.
It's been criticized for being, you know, wizardry, and some Christian fundamentalists have said this is paganism and all that. Yet you say in some ways the series satisfies a religious thirst.
Oh yeah, I have no doubt about that. After all, paganism is a religion. It's just not.
Though we heard one of our young correspondents just now say, in the end, she believes he'll die for us. That's a familiar.
Well,
line.
There you go. But I do think that, you know, religion now is become a very vexed word, right? There are religious people, and then there are the so-called cultural sophisticates who scorn religion. But I do think that it's impossible to go through life without some kind of moral structure, and we all try to build one up for ourselves. And here's a book that has one, and while you're reading the book, you're sharing it with hundreds of millions of other people.
Mm. Julie, you've shared it with your offspring. When you're reading to kids, your own or others, what do you think you're conveying to them? What is it that they're picking up? The fun of a good story? Are they really going with the good and evil theme? Do you see that fear in their eyes and maybe courage coming as well?
I think they have been somewhat frightened by the books. The younger one is only 4, but the older one is 9 and has not yet wanted to finish one of them. I think they make her anxious. But what she does appreciate, and what I think finally, fundamentally, is the greatness of the books, is the imagination, the variety of them, you know, Bertie Bott's Every Flavor Beans, right. The Sorting Hat, the invention of Quidditch. Hagrid, the characters, the names. There's a very Tolkienist sense of names in this book. They're extremely rich. I will never finally believe that these books don't turn kids on to reading. It's impossible to me. And in fact, I'm almost surprised when very, very passionate fans of the books see the movies, because the movies seem superfluous. They can't possibly compete with the books, finally.
Well, kind of flat once you've imagined all that stuff.
Yeah, the language isn't there. So I always find that. And I do know passionate fans of the books who won't see the movies.
Craig, there's a lot of talk about good and evil here, and yet you point out that at some point, after 9/11, I guess, I don't know if that's part of the reason or not, that depiction of good and evil gets complicated here. The lines get fuzzy. She takes away the sort of clear delineation.
Right. Well, it was already starting, I think, early on. I mean, the first few books are much more like traditional children's books or fairy tales with sort of a binary good and evil. But as things go on, you have a complication. For example, Professor Snape, who seems evil, seems to dislike Harry intensely. We find out through his memory that Professor Snape's interactions with Harry's father, maybe Harry's father was cruel to Professor Snape in an unfair way. And that really throws Harry for a loop, a kind of moral loop. In addition, I think as somebody earlier mentioned, I think that Rowling is responding directly to 9/11 in Order of the Phoenix when she has the so-called good guys respond to the threat of terrorism and of evil with terror. Professor Umbridge is this kind of sadistic, bureaucratic, smiling bureaucrat, or wonderfully realized character, I think, who tortures children in order to find information. And this seems to be Rowling's commentary on the dangers of the British or the Americans' response to so-called evildoers. So that we in our response can become the very evil that we're fighting against. So that's complicated of the binary.
Mm, things do get murky. The Times reviewer Michiko Kakutani, who says she managed to buy the book this week in Manhattan, has read it and reviewed it, The Accursed Kakutani by J.K. Rowling, but says, you know, Dumbledore, Snape, Dudley Dursley, all are going to turn out to be more complicated than they seem. And an interesting line that the lesson in the end, that choice more than talent or predisposition, she writes, will be shown to matter most of all, choice over predisposition. Gail's calling from Merle's Inlet, North Carolina. Hi, Gail. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you. I just wanted to say that I have enjoyed every single book. I live for these books. They're just marvelous. And I was telling the woman mm-hmm. who answered mm-hmm. that I have ovarian cancer and I'm going into my 6th year as a survivor.
Good
and
for
that
you.
These books keep me going, and I swear I'm not going to die until that last movie is out.
Oh, wow.
And I haven't read 6 and 7. I only read up to as far as the most present movie, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yes, I do. Gail, let me ask you, you're 62 years old, so that's not a short life. In that span, what other books or series of books have moved you like this one?
None have ever moved me like this.
Have you always been a big reader?
I like to read a lot, but life always seems to get in the way with kids and grandkids and pets and things like that, and of course, my illness has really gotten in the way of a lot of things, but these books, there's just something, and it's a silly word, but there's something so magical about them. I mean, they just pull you in, and it makes me forget all the things I'm dealing with, you know, and brings me into another realm, and I just love that. I just love that, and I want to find out. I don't want Harry to die. I don't want any of them to die. I want this to go on forever.
There's the urge to be transported. Gail, we hope you live well through the last movie and well beyond and are buoyed up by it the whole way along, and thanks for calling. Lee, this longing to be transported, you don't have to have ovarian cancer to feel that, you've said, and many clearly feel.
Yeah, it's very inspiring to hear the last caller speak like that. What writer would not want to hear that?
Yes.
And I think that Rowling has, as I said, she has conveyed her own passionate, life-loving, life-affirming desire to transform the givens of her life into her readers. That heroic, life-loving last caller is proof of that. I can't think of any other writer who creates these kinds of feelings in readers.
Julie, it is interesting to think that J.K. Rowling has been out there living and writing along with us as we've lived through this last decade. So 9/11 was there. Everything we've seen was there as the moral coloring of her book has emerged. It's emerged from the same sort of contemporary, mess of events that we're all living through.
It's an amazing moment for to have been writing these books. And, you know, I tell my kids, you have to remember when the seventh book came out, and they look at me a little blankly because, of course, that's all they know. They can't realize what has it been, a 12-year span or a bit, or that's the time.
Since
in
the
which
UK
she was,
publication, yeah.
And since she was writing them.
Yeah.
I have to say, I do think this is an amazing moment for children's literature in general. There are, in fact, other books to read. And when I hear that kids reread these books over and over again, I understand that because they want to re-enter that world. But they should try Philip Pullman, and they should try Lois Lowry and M.T. Anderson and some other young adult writers right now who are doing some remarkable things. And it's a question, why now? I mean, these are the people winning the National Book Award and who are also being read by adults. But, true, they don't create the complete universe that Rowling has managed to create.
But I do want
people will discover them.
Right. I do wonder about that with so many kids reading. For many of them, this has become, the main line of their youth's reading, all from one author, a whole lot of it from one author. Our young Asher said he's not sure it's so very, very well written, but the story is compelling. I mean, Craig, does this become the literary music in the minds of a whole generation? Are we going to, be reading stories and essays years from now that still echo an education in Harry Potter for a whole generation?
I think so, and mostly because of two reasons. The fans and the readers have sort of taken Harry into their own. They've taken ownership. The fan fiction is a remarkable phenomenon.
People writing their own offshoots of the J.K. Rowling.
Right, literally thousands of fans write online their own versions where they have their own alternative histories, alternative romances, and transgressive romances. All of these are online, and I think those are going to go on. And plus, it's entering the popular culture. I mean, everybody knows what a scar, a lightning bolt scar means, and there'll be an amusement park section in Florida, Harry Potter land. So it's entered the popular culture in ways that I think will keep it alive. Plus, it really does fulfill a lot of these complex needs that young people have, and touches on so many things. And it's a heterocosm, as Lee pointed out. I mean, it's a complex, and Julie pointed out, it's a complex world that Rowling has created. Plus, I think Lee was right about the romanticism. I mean, children's literature, not just Rowling. I mean, I want to emphasize mm-hmm. that and agree with Julie. A lot of children's literature is quite romantic in that it deals with transcendent and complex themes that sometimes have been ignored in so-called adult literature. Mm. So for all those reasons, I think it's going to stay alive for quite a long time.
Let's go to Sarah in Milford, Massachusetts. Hi, Sarah. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I actually was just talking about the way J.K. Rowling captures children and how they grow up. I'm actually a speech-language pathologist, and I work with young children, and I often read books that make young children sound more stupid than they are. And I use stupid, the word, loosely, but most of the children that I've worked with really have so much depth, and she really captures that in her books, and I always miss those children when I finish the books.
You miss J.K. Rowling's children.
Oh, I miss Harry Potter. I will end a book and look at my husband and say, oh, I miss Harry. When's the next book coming out?
Yeah, everybody does. But you're right. And Julie, you can read it. I mean, she takes the kids seriously. They're engaged in big stuff, saving the world here practically, Julie.
Well, yes, as wise parents know, children are just shorter people. They are not stupid at all. They're little witnesses sometimes, and they understand more than they can articulate. And Rowling absolutely gets that. And she gets, I think, another fundamental thing will always be about what drew kids to this initially was the feeling of the powerless, neglected child. It's really a child abuse situation. He's locked in a cupboard under the stairs. He's never had a birthday party. He's only given ill-fitting too large clothes
it's
to wear.
It's the old Cinderella, Snow White, Oliver Twist story.
It is, and absolutely is. It goes back hundreds and hundreds of years, and I mean that only as the highest compliment. It boggles my mind when people say these books are derivative. No, they very cleverly combine the richest themes that children's literature has always been driven by.
So, Lee, do you have a hope for the last one? I mean, everybody's rooting for something, it seems, in the way this turns out. Or are you just, going to let it wash over you? What's your approach?
I'll let it wash over me. My hope is that somehow, even though it ends as a book, it ends in such a way that the story keeps going and keeps unfolding and readers' imaginations. I do want to say one thing about the children and the way they're portrayed. Although they are very sophisticated, as Julie said, they are indeed. They're also innocent. They're vulnerable. In the end, they're often helpless. They're at the mercy of a very harsh and cruel powers. And I think we forget in our society that children, as we turn them into, or as certain forces in the society turn them into commercial entities and consuming entities, the knowing mm-hmm. child, the hip child, the children are innocent for all of that. And to think they're not is somewhat pernicious. And I think this book is, in that sense, it just has a very robust and good and decent sense of life.
Mm. Well, Michiko Kakutani, who has read it, says, don't worry, no postmodern ambiguous Sopranos ending here. It's going to be monumental and epic. Craig Spunkin, your final thought as Harry Potter goes off into the mists of Hogwarts and beyond. What are you hoping for, wishing for, remembering?
Well, I'm just hoping for a wonderful read, and I'm glad I avoided any of the spoilers, all the people, sort of mean-spirited people trying to ruin our fun and read the last book. And, there are a lot of themes that Rowling is exploring, and hopefully she'll be able to tie those up nicely and in an emotional and fulfilling way.
Well, the lines are growing, the anticipation builds, and it's been wonderful having all of you to kind of look forward in advance of the book dropping. Craig Svonkin in Riverside, California. Craig, thanks a lot for being with us this hour.
Thanks.
Lee Siegel at the New Republic. Lee, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
And Julie Just, children's book editor at the New York Times Book Review. Julie, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Happy reading, everybody. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.